First case on the calendar is it Couton?
It's A. Couton, Your Honor.
Okay.
May I approach?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor.
How much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 4 minutes, please, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Ray Deary. I am plaintiff's counsel, appellant counsel for Ann Couton. About a year ago, we had a trial in this case, and the focus of the trial was on an automobile accident and what caused her injuries and what injuries were caused by the automobile accident. The focus of the trial was on thoracic outlet syndrome. The focus of the thoracic outlet syndrome was basically a contest between my side, plaintiff's side, saying that it was caused by this automobile accident. My evidence was supported by three treating physicians, none of whom were paid forensic experts. The opposite side had a CR 35, Civil Rule 35, IME, defense forensic physician, as is their right. And the contest was between those competing forces. On the one hand, the plaintiff, we argued through the evidence that this automobile accident of 2010 was caused her thoracic outlet syndrome. She needed surgery as well. That was all laid out in the record. There were $23,000 in medical bills. The two doctors that I asked to testify on that testified that more reasonably and probably than not, that those were caused by this accident.
The issue on appeal, as I understand your briefing, is whether or not the court abused its discretion in its ruling on the motion to eliminate. So why don't we move directly to that?
Sure. In this case, the question was whether or not a 28-year-old collarbone injury was admissible. We don't believe that it was. We believe the court abused its discretion in bringing in a 28-year-old collarbone injury, that there's not a shred of evidence in the record that there was any symptoms whatsoever, Your Honor.
Well, the declaration of Richard M. Kramer, is it?
I believe that's how it's...
That was submitted in response to the motion suggests otherwise. Would you please address that? Specifically, his declaration indicates, one, that the cause of the, or the damages here, were not related to the auto injury, the basis of your suit, and also indicated that, and I'm quoting here, given plaintiff's long-standing and chronic complaints of neck and back pain, it is more likely than not that plaintiff continued to suffer from symptomatic conditions prior to the subject accident on a more probable than not basis. And then attached is the CR35 report.
Well, again, Your Honor, there's no evidence that she ever suffered from any injury related or any symptoms related to the collarbone injury. She had previous back problems and neck problems, but the court excluded that evidence. The jury did not hear that she had any back or neck problems. She did have an automobile accident 3 years prior to this accident. So I believe Dr. Kramer was talking about that, but there's not a single medical record. There's not any testimony whatsoever that she suffered any problems from this collarbone injury. And so that was the focus. That's why we appealed in this case, because if you look at the record, and as we both highlighted and briefed in our briefing, the contest was, okay, what's causing the thoracic outlet syndrome? My three doctors said this. Dr. Kramer says, I don't know what it is, but if it's anything, it is this collarbone injury. And that's not sufficient under the law, first of all. And second of all, even if it were, this collarbone injury under 50 years of case law in the state of Washington is inadmissible. They have to show prior symptoms. They have to show some sort of complaint, some symptoms, some going to the doctor. There's nothing. So how does the court bring in a 28-year-old collarbone injury in this case? I submit to you that is an egregious abuse of discretion 28 years, and nothing, not one single complaint related to this collarbone. All it was in an IME examination, they felt a callus. That's all it was. She never complained about it. She never saw the doctor about it. And then that was the focus at trial. The last question asked by the jury, which I attached as Addendum A to my reply brief to Dr. Kramer, was what were the causes of others getting TO?
Why does a jury's question during trial have anything to do with the court's ruling on the motion to eliminate pretrial?
Well, first of all, I believe it's an abuse of discretion. Then the second part of the analysis, of course, is whether or not it's harmless error. And in the briefing supplied by the respondents, they say, first of all, it was either cumulative or insignificant. First of all, it couldn't be cumulative by definition. This, we're saying the original introduction of this evidence was in itself inadmissible, so it can't be cumulative. Was it insignificant? Of course it was not insignificant. This was the focus of their defense. They're saying, we don't think this automobile accident caused the thoracic outlet syndrome. If anything caused her thoracic outlet syndrome, it was a dormant, unsymptomatic condition that she had in her collarbone for 28 years. No symptoms. I can't prove anything in the record. That's what's really causing it. The problem with that is that's an abuse of discretion because it never should have come in. And it also was the focus of their case, as shown by the jury's own question to the witness. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Colin Hutchinson on behalf of respondents. May it please the court. Appellant's request for a new trial should be denied for four primary reasons. One, appellant's clavicle fracture is relevant evidence that supports respondent's alternative theory of causation, specifically that this is a natural progression of a pre-existing condition, a permanent structural change that has been present for 28 years. Point two, that appellant's cited case law misses the mark because this alternative theory is not one of an aggravation of a pre-existing condition. It's the natural progression of a pre-existing condition, and that's the key determination this court must make here in determining if any error occurred. Point three, if
when you say natural progression, I assume, but I want to be clear, that you mean that it was symptomatic or not.
I don't think that that's the key determination here. The key determination under Harris v. Drake is if there's symptomatic condition prior to the accident lighting it up. And here Dr. Kramer's testimony is that this is the natural progression of a pre-existing condition. There's no requirement that there be symptomology prior to if this is just the natural progression of a pre-existing condition.
Well, if we look at the declaration that Dr. Kramer submitted in conjunction, I believe, with the motion in limine, he says that plaintiff's longstanding and chronic complaints of neck and back pain is more likely than not that plaintiff continued to suffer from symptomatic conditions prior to the subject accident on a more probable than not basis. So how do you square that testimony with what you're arguing?
Well, Your Honor, that's a good question. And what it comes down to is that is the doctor's opinion, and that
Well, that's what the court's looking at. So the question is whether the court abused its discretion in granting the motion limit.
Well, I think in viewing his testimony, that's why the court didn't abuse its discretion, is because he did testify that he did believe that there was symptomology prior to. My argument here is that when viewing the case law, there seems to be two different pathways to go. There's the Harris v. Drake, where you need immediate prior symptomology prior to an accident in order to bring
right.
that in. And there's also the natural progression of a pre-existing condition, and that's in jury instruction 30.18. And
so pre-trial, what does this testimony mean? Is it related to symptomatic? It seems to.
Yes, I would agree. I would agree. He testified that she had symptomology prior to this accident.
So this doesn't have anything to do with natural progression.
Well,
When
you turn to the trial testimony.
I know, but this testimony.
That testimony is not about the natural progression. That's about the prior symptomology. And that's why the court didn't abuse its discretion in allowing it in. But when you turn to the trial testimony, it becomes more clear that this is a natural progression of a pre-existing condition.
You refer to a WPI 30.18. Is there a case that underlies that? In other words, your natural progression theory?
It's outlined briefly in the Hoskins case that's cited by both parties. where the court says that if there is testimony regarding the natural progression of a pre-existing condition, this instruction should be given and the jury should consider that natural progression in calculating damages.
Well, given there is no appeal of the giving of that instruction, let's just focus on what the basis of the trial court's opinion or ruling was in the motion for limine that occurred pretrial.
And the declaration also states that this condition was brought on by this pre-existing condition teamed with the weight gain and postural issues that the appellant had following the accident, and that is what brought on these subjective complaints, and that was the cause of these subjective complaints.
So when an individual says, I haven't had any symptoms related to my 28-year-old broken collarbone, and an expert witness says, on a more probable-than-not basis, you must have had symptoms. Is that enough to trigger the Harris v. Drake analysis, satisfy it?
Under Harris v. Drake, I believe it would be, because that would depend on a number of factors. One, here in this case, the appellant had some longstanding, well-documented issues with her memory as a result of taking prescription medication. There's serious questions in any of her testimony regarding things that she remembers separate and apart from her records. And the medical testimony here is that this pre-existing condition, when teamed with weight gain, is going to restrict the blood flow to her extremities and result in these subjective complaints that she did complain about that started several months after the accident. And when you do view appellant's own expert testimony at trial, their own experts contradicted their own final conclusions regarding thoracic outlet syndrome because they testified that traumatically induced thoracic outlet syndrome would need to present within a couple months. And the records indicate that this was seven months after the accident.
But isn't the question whether, under Harris v. Drake analysis, whether prior to this current incident there were symptoms present?
And that is what Dr. Kramer testified right to in his declaration that the court reviewed in granting or denying the motion in limine to exclude.
So that becomes an issue of credibility for the fact finder?
For the fact finder to determine, correct, Your Honor. Turning back to Judge Cox, your question regarding a case that follows that 30.18, we believe that the Torno case is really directly on point with the situation here. In Torno, like here, there was defense expert testimony that the subject accidents did not cause the subjective complaints, but that they were the natural progression of a pre-existing condition, separate and apart from the accident. That's why the court in Torno and the court here gave jury instruction 30.18, that states there should be no award for damages for the natural progression of a pre-existing condition. And that's really exactly what we have here, is testimony at trial that this accident did not cause thoracic outlet syndrome, did not cause the symptoms that the appellant related several months following the accident. Therefore, this clavicle fracture, despite the fact that it was 28 years old, was properly before the jury, properly considered by the jury in calculating damages, and no error occurred. And when you do turn to Harris v. Drake, the key point that case stands for is that when an accident lights up and makes active a pre-existing condition, that pre-existing condition cannot be the proximate cause of the resulting damages. And when you view Dr. Kramer's testimony, that is not at all what he testifies to. He's not testifying that this accident lit up or made active a pre-existing condition. It's that this happened as a result of the weight gain and the postural issues, which I think takes Harris v. Drake really out of the consideration here when you view the trial testimony. And we don't think that an error occurred in any trial. A new trial should not be granted here. When you do view this evidence coming in, assuming you do find it was error, it certainly would not be prejudicial because there were so many other issues regarding appellant's case at trial that this is merely insignificant when you view the whole record as a whole. And I've briefed that well in the respondent's brief, but I'll touch on a few key points briefly. The primary care physician, when he initially examined appellant, didn't find any numbness and tingling, no thoracic outlet symptoms. Dr. Lynch, the physiatrist, examined her 8 months afterwards. He testified that traumatically induced thoracic outlet syndrome should come in within a couple months at the upper bound. And that's not what we have here. That's not what's supported in Dr. Riegel's records, the primary care physician, of numbness and tingling 7 months following the accident. Then we turn to the specialist, Dr. Umbellaro, who didn't actually examine her until 2015. He had a tech do an exam in 2012 that Dr. Kramer testified was not done correctly, and that the results are actually don't indicate thoracic outlet syndrome. His own examination didn't demonstrate thoracic outlet syndrome. So the jury's hearing all of this evidence before it even considers this fractured clavicle, which really makes the fractured clavicle a drop in the bucket, so to speak. It's cumulative to all the other issues in determining what this accident caused in terms of the injuries. So really, we don't think this is prejudicial in any way. Appellant argues that the jury must have relied on this fractured clavicle and totally ignores all the other issues with their case in chief. We don't believe that any error occurred. We think that the jury's verdict is warranted and is supported by the evidence as a whole. We don't believe that any error occurred, but if error did occur, it's really a drop in the bucket. A new trial is not warranted. We think appellant failed to prove her case at trial, and the jury's verdict supports that determination, and this appeal should be denied. Thank you. I'm happy to field any other questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to address a couple of issues. First off, right out of the gate, Your Honors asked counsel a couple of pointed legal questions, and I think that they go right to the heart of the problem. Counsel, in his briefing and again this morning, talks about this as a natural progression case. By English dictionary standards, this cannot be a natural progression case because there's not a shred of evidence whatsoever that this was symptomatic prior to this accident, not one, for 28 years. And Dr. Kramer testified in a declaration it was his speculative opinion that she may have had some symptoms and didn't know it. That contradicts the very founding or the bedrock of these cases. You have to show symptomatology. You got to show some sort of complaints. You have to show something. You can't just have a doctor come in and say, I think she must have been feeling something. Counsel was asked in a follow-up to that, there's no requirement of symptomatology. That was, I believe, his quote. That's directly at odds with the case law in this case. And I do think it's important to note that the counsel's relying upon the Torno case. And I was surprised in reading the Torno case that, frankly, it even existed. But one of the things that we must note at, the Torno case, 133 Washington App, both parties did cite to it in their briefing, but there's no analysis whatsoever of 50 years of case law involving pre-existing conditions and the need for symptomatology. So why the Court of Appeals chose not to analyze that, I don't know. Maybe it was factually distinguishable. Maybe the parties didn't brief it. But I know one thing. It completely ignores it. And frankly, that's what I think respondents are doing here, saying, well, there's no requirement of symptomatology. Of course there is. That's the bedrock of this legal principle. It's also really the bedrock of tort law in many respects. You take the plaintiff as you find them. This is an eggshell plaintiff case. And if you have no symptomatology of someone who has a soft shell skull or something like that, you can't just say, okay, well, everything relates to the soft shell plaintiff's skull, and therefore this person's not liable. That's very much very similar to what's happening here. They talk about weight gain and postural issues. She was, according to the record, 138 pounds at the age of 50 at the time of this accident, 5'6" tall. Give me a break. There's no issue of weight gain. It was a tangential issue that's often brought up any time a defense doctor is going to want to ascribe some sort of vice to a plaintiff. That was not an issue. Postural issues, I don't even know, frankly, what they're talking about. And then they also cite that she didn't show any symptoms whatsoever. And I cite to it in my reply brief. On page 4 of my reply brief, citing to it at Exhibit 1 and 2, supplemental designation of clerk's paper, she had numbness and tingling at Dr. Riegel's first appointment. So bottom line is, this is a case where this evidence never should have brought in. It was a focus of the defense's case, and it can't be insignificant. It can't be. It was the focus of their case. It can't be cumulative, since it should never have been brought in the first place. My client should be entitled to a just trial, not a trial about 28-year collarbone when she was in college, relating to when she was 50 years old in a car accident. That's not fair, and that's not what the law says. Thank you.
Thank you. The next case on the calendar.